Now, yesterday, an inquest jury announced their advisory verdict that there was probable cause of a crime in the death of an inmate at a Milwaukee County jail last year. The man died of dehydration after 7 days without water.
Jacob Carpenter joins us now for the details. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jacob, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start with what we heard from this inquest jury. On what grounds did they say, hey, yeah, this is a crime that this could be worth prosecuting?
Yeah, the jury decided that there was probable cause for a felony, a low-level felony charge of abuse of a prisoner, and it applied to seven people that worked at the jail. It includes a jail commander, a jail lieutenant, and five corrections officers. All but the jail commander had connections or were involved in the care of Terrell Thomas prior to his death in the jail.
And this, to be clear, this is an inquest jury. This is not a jury that ruled on guilt or innocence. They're recommending to the district attorney that charges should be filed.
Correct. It's all that they do in this situation is they hear testimony from witnesses, they hear statements from prosecutors, they view evidence, and they decide whether they believe unanimously that there is probable cause to charge anybody. What happens now is that the prosecutor will take that into consideration. He does not have to follow what the jury decided or what their verdict was, and he will look at all the facts, what the jury recommended, and then he will make a decision on whether there will be any charges brought. And at that point, it will go through, I guess, what you would consider a more traditional court process.
Now, let's go back to the story. Remind us what happened to Terrell Thomas.
Sure. Terrell Thomas was taken into the Milwaukee County Jail, which is run by the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office, in April of 2016. He had bipolar disorder and was not taking medication, and his family has said that he was in the throes of essentially a mental breakdown. He had shot a man who survived the gunshot wound, and then Terrell Thomas opened fire in a casino, fired off several rounds, did not hit anybody, according to police that responded. But once he was taken into custody, he flooded a cell, and because of that, he was placed in the solitary confinement where he spent 7 days there. Somebody had turned off his water at the beginning of his placement in solitary, and they just never remembered to turn it on. And because, through a variety of circumstances, nobody knew that his water was off, nobody went back to turn it on. And prosecutors have said that because of his mental state, that he was not able to ask for help. He was not able to ask for water. And since nobody gave him any water there, he eventually died of dehydration in the jail.
What did we learn in the course of the inquest? We've been hearing about the testimony as this has been going on.
We learned that there are numerous policy violations here. At the beginning, somebody turned his water off because essentially preemptively, and that goes against policy violations. The officer who's accused of turning it off never logged that in any type of whiteboard that they had there to note any type of significant changes to inmates. They never put it in a jail log that is supposed to document everything that gets done at the jail for the most part. We found that there were officers who saw Terrell Thomas. He was naked. He was splayed out on a cell floor. He was unresponsive. He didn't have a mattress in his cell. And yet those officers who were with him on essentially his last hours never sought help for him. And then there were questions of whether the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office administrators responded to police detectives in a quick manner because there was surveillance video that was taped over and was not downloaded in a more timely fashion.
And it also came out that other inmates after this death had had their water cut off. Do I understand that right?
It sounds like there were two inmates who had their water preemptively cut off. Obviously, neither of those got to the point of Mr. Thomas's situation. That did happen pretty soon after Mr. Thomas's death. And at that point, it wasn't believed that he had died of dehydration. It was everybody at that time suspected that this was because of natural causes of some type, something most likely health related. He was not in the most outstanding physical shape. It didn't really start coming out that dehydration would be a possibility for the cause of death here until about 2 months after he had died. And that was when we had started asking questions of the sheriff's office, because we had been hearing accounts that he from inmates that he might have been deprived of water. And the medical examiner's office started to, based on their investigation, started to suspect that as well.
We're talking to Jacob Carpenter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at this recommendation from an inquest jury suggesting charges against Milwaukee County jail workers in the death of Terrell Thomas, the dehydration death of an inmate after he had had his water cut off for a week. A lot of people have been focusing on this sheriff himself, David Clark, wondering if he would be included in this somehow, looking for statements from him. What do we know about Sheriff Clark as it relates to this inquest jury?
Well, he hasn't said much. He did release a statement yesterday that essentially said this is an ongoing process, and we will, you know, respect that process as it makes its way through the courts. That being said, you know, this is a case that had numerous policy violations, that had, you know, many people in the sheriff's office involved. And, you know, there are those who had wanted to see a more proactive response, especially considering, you know, it was an inmate with a mental illness that, you know, was essentially what, according to the inquest jury, is a victim here. And so, you know, there are mental health advocates who have said that they wanted a greater response, and who have said that Sheriff Clark, through a couple of statements, has sort of indirectly been callous about the death in this case.
Has the district attorney said anything about whether anybody beyond the seven people indicated by the inquest jury could potentially face charges?
He has said that it could be zero, it could be more than seven, it could be somewhere between zero and seven. It's completely up to his discretion at this point. We have not gotten any sort of indication as to which way he is leaning. I will say that, you know, they were pretty thorough in presenting the evidence here. There was never a feeling during my time at the inquest that this was any kind of whitewash or that this was anything that they were looking to, you know, try to cover for the sheriff's office or the corrections officers or anything of that sort. But all of that being said, you know, this is a difficult case, and while it's clear that there were policies violated, proving that those turned into a criminal act is definitely more challenging.
Do we know now if rules have changed or been clarified on when water can be cut off to an inmate at the jail?
Yeah, we do. There was some testimony that came out from the corrections officers and the jail's administrators during the inquest. We haven't heard these directly from the sheriff, who has not said whether he's changed anything there. But we do know that corrections officers no longer are allowed to shut off water, that there were essentially the key that is used to get access to water valves has been moved so that it's not easily accessible for corrections officers. It appears that an extra surveillance camera was added to the jail solitary confinement wing. It sounds like there was a new video system that was installed that should be able to retain video longer. As it was, it started overwriting after about 60 days or so. So we definitely know that there are some changes that have been made. What has not been done is nobody, as far as we know, according to the county records that we've seen, nobody has been fired, nobody has been demoted, nobody has been suspended for more than 10 days. Now, all of that could still come. There are definitely people who believe that you should wait on those types of things and those types of internal investigations until a criminal investigation is completed. But there are also those who think that, you know, the sheriff has the authority and maybe should take more swift action in this case.
The family of Terrell Thomas, I understand, has been watching this inquest process closely. What do we know about their reaction to the recommendations of charges being filed?
We know that they are, you know, they're happy to see that this is being taken seriously. We know that, you know, it's a long process for them. You know, there are different parts of the family that one side of the family has filed a federal lawsuit. the other another side of the family has retained a lawyer, but they're kind of more in a wait and see phase to see what comes out from the inquest, what comes out from any criminal case. But you know, everybody involved with the family that I've spoken with, you know, they want to see what they believe is justice served here, and it's hard to argue with them given, you know, that we have seen what everybody admits are policy violations. We've seen experts say that he was held in inhumane, unconscionable conditions, and even the jail's top administrators have said this was a preventable death. So, you know, they definitely want to see justice done in this case. They want to see it through the criminal side, and they will definitely try to see it through the civil side as well.
And as we wrap up, have we seen any indication from the district attorney about when a decision will be reached on actually filing charges?
We don't have a very definitive date or anything of that sort, but he did say that he wants to make a decision as soon as possible. And so I would not expect to be waiting months for this this decision. I would expect to see it in the very near future.
Jacob, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jacob Carpenter, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us to talk about news that an inquest jury just released their decision that the death of a Milwaukee County jail inmate after 7 days without water was a probable crime. Give a listen. The sound of sizzling bacon and the delicious smell that goes along with it is a good indication of how far along the cooking is and whether it's time to turn it or serve it up.
Our next guest says we should pay more attention to all of our senses when we're cooking. Julia Moskin is a food writer for the New York Times, and you can find her list of 10 ways to develop your food senses on the Central Time Facebook page. Julia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot of us, when we're cooking, we think about how food tastes. We take a little tasting spoon. We take a look at it. Does it look brown? But you're saying that there's a whole range of the other senses that we're ignoring that can really up our cooking game. Why are those other senses so important?
Well, I think a lot of people know or perhaps are learning that a big component of taste is actually smell. And that doesn't only apply to the fact that, you know, if you're blindfolded and you bite into a potato or an apple, it's very hard to tell the difference. If you're an experienced cook, you can actually smell when a steak is done. You can smell when your scrambled eggs are ready. You can smell all sorts of things that a more inexperienced cook doesn't think about. And that was sort of the idea for this article. One of the main senses that I noticed that cooks who are, for example, visually impaired use is hearing.
Let's talk about how we develop this, because talking about smell, I feel like I do this now. I know when olive oil smells like it's just heated up enough, but it took me a long time to get there. How do we intentionally acquire these skills apart from just cooking a lot over the years?
Well, certainly cooking is really the best way to learn to cook. There isn't really a magic shortcut. But you can kind of try to pay attention to some of these things. And one thing that I was working with a chef who was blind on this story, and I had her come to my kitchen, and we talked about I had her blindfold me, and she had me listening to the different sounds of a simmer, a boil, and a fast boil, for example, for water, or the sound of what a steak should sound like when it's in a frying pan. It really should be a steady, even sound. If you're hearing popping, if you're hearing these sort of rhythmic changes, that means that you're probably cooking it at too high a heat. So it's not only cooking, but cooking and just trying to pay a little bit of attention can really pay off.
And you were talking about listening and how you were learning. One of the things you write about is learning to listen to a cake. So apparently a cake makes a different sound when it's not quite done and when it's done baking. How can you hear that?
Well, you know, this is a long time thing that this wonderful Southern cook, Edna Lewis, who grew up in Virginia and in a community that was started by freed slaves, and she lived well into, I'm not sure, the 21st century, but she really brought a lot of kitchen wisdom. And one of them was listening to a sponge cake. And if you think about it, it really makes sense. What her point was is that it stops ticking. when it's done. But what that means is, you know, when a cake is cooking, when it's rising, the steam inside the little cells of, for example, a sponge cake is expanding and popping. And so when that is no longer happening, sort of when you're like when you're like at sleepaway camp and you can hear how the popcorn isn't popping anymore, that's when it's done.
So do you have to hold the cake up right next to your ear, or is this audible enough that
you can... Do not put your head in the oven. Take the cake out and just hold it up to your ear. You do have to listen rather closely. And I learned that from a woman who teaches something called Pie Workshops, and she has Pie Camp, Kate McDermott. And she is a very quirky pie baker out in the state of Washington. And she says, and this was actually my primary inspiration for the article, she talks about the heartbeat of a pie.
And you use the phrase in the piece, the sizzle womp of a pie.
Yes. That's
which I love.
I know.
That
really
was worth the price of admission all by itself.
The heartbeat is much more lyrical, but the sizzle womp tells you what you're listening for.
It's what's happening there.
The sizzle is of the fat in a pie crust. Obviously, that would be lard or Crisco or butter, whatever it is that you use. But what's really happening is that you're cooking the flour in the pie crust when you're baking it. And so just like any other kind of cooking in fat, you're going to hear a little bit of sizzle. That means that the crust is actually cooking along nicely, and the wump is the bubbling of the filling. When a filling is thickened, because it has to be at a certain temperature with things like tapioca or flour, it's only when they reach a certain temperature that they're thickened, and that thick liquid bumping up against the top crust makes kind of a wump, wump, wump sound. Wow. So you're hearing the sizzle and the wump, and that's the heartbeat of the pie.
Well, we know that, for instance, when a person loses their eyesight, some other senses become more acute, maybe sense of touch, to compensate and to get that same information in different ways. For cooking, for our purposes, using the senses to be a better cook, does it take a long time to develop these skills?
Well, certainly if you have no choice. For example, the blind cook that I worked with, whose name is Christine Ha, and she actually won a season of the show MasterChef. She had sight, and then she lost her sight during her 20s. And a neurologist I worked with on the story explained to me that what happens over a long period of time is that the neurons that are attached to your eyes actually can be refocused to your fingertips. So the piece of your brain that takes in information from your eyes will actually be redirected, and your fingertips will become much more sensitive. And it's definitely something that is hard for those of us who don't use touch exclusively to understand. But it is something like a really good example of that is to use coarse salt. And, you know, that's something that a lot of times a recipe will call for a quarter of a teaspoon of salt, half a teaspoon of salt. And you have to go get your measuring spoons. You have to go, you know, pour it in carefully, and you usually end up spilling a lot on the counter. And what Christine does is that she has memorized the feeling in her fingers of a quarter of a teaspoon of salt. And that's actually really easy to do. I did it, you know, in 10 minutes, just doing it over and over again. And, you know, it really is the kind of thing that saves time and that the kind of thing that makes people enjoy cooking. Because let's face it, when cooking takes forever, when you have to measure everything, when you don't have the knife skills to cut an onion, it's not fun. But there are so many ways that you can educate not only your palate, but also your ears, your nose, your fingertips to become a quicker cook.
Talking to Julia Moskin, New York Times food reporter, talking about how we can use the power of all of our senses in our cooking to make our cooking better. And Julia, you write, and this seems to be one overarching message here, sometimes relying on the simmer for 2 minutes or low heat or whatever, the really precise instructions that might be in a recipe, isn't going to do us as much good as paying attention with all our senses.
You're right, Rob. It's really an amazing thing when you start thinking about it, because recipes, of course, now we have video recipes. We have a lot of different additional ways of learning how to cook or being taught. But essentially, recipes are, you know, one-dimensional words on a page that are trying to describe a very complicated, multidimensional, real-world, five-senses experience. And it's really not possible. As someone who writes recipes for a living, it is really difficult to write if you wrote absolutely every step, every recipe would be thousands of words long. So you really do have the ability to learn a lot of these sensory cues so that you won't have to follow, you know, what it says. I mean, when you're browning onions, now some people feel, in some recipes it says, oh, that takes 8 to 10 minutes. In some recipes it says 25 to 30 minutes. And that really depends on how fast you're cooking it, how often you're stirring it. And you can tell by learning, you know, what your way of cooking onions is. And the sensory cues, like you know it's done when it smells a certain way, when it looks a certain way, and then you don't have to rely on recipes. And frankly, most of your dishes will turn out better.
If you think about cooking shows that are on today, there's often stuff going on in the background. They're kind of noisy and bustly. Does this mean that we should be thinking about cooking as more of a sort of sensory deprivation tank? Well, maybe not the right word there, but where there's not music in the background, there's not a TV blaring, you're not focusing on 10 different things, but you're very honed in on just the sounds of things and the feel of things, less distractions.
Definitely. It also can really be pleasant. There is a series of videos on YouTube. It's called, if you look up Silent Cooking, of people listening to just the sounds of cooking, of someone chopping onions in a very orderly way, someone grating chocolate. I mean, there is a sort of soothing, meditative quality about preparing food that a lot of people find. Now, obviously, if you get home at 6 on a Tuesday and you have to get dinner on the table at 6:30, you're not going to be in a meditative mood. But I do find that on Sundays, for example, or anytime when you have a little extra time, you know, if you kind of have I hesitate to use the word mindful because it's kind of overused these days, but that is related to sensory cooking, and you're just paying attention to the sounds of things, the feeling of things, and I really find that you can, you know, have a pretty relaxing time and feel better afterwards, and you have a good dinner for your family.
Yeah, you write about actually a brain state that people can go into. It's something like when somebody is brushing your hair or something like that. If you really get into this in this right mode, you're actually entering this different state of, I don't know, consciousness is quite it, but a happier mental zone.
Yeah, it's something called ASMR, and it is some people even like to listen to other people eating. That's the other food aspect of it, and in addition to cooking, and they think about, oh my God, that cheeseburger looks so delicious. And maybe it's because they're on a diet and they're not eating cheeseburgers, but yeah, there is kind of this trance-like state that some people do get from these sounds of cooking. I think that is, you know, a pretty specialized version of this.
And Julia, we've talked about several of them, but could you leave us with a couple exercises to try in the kitchen to get better at this?
Well, certainly the listening is really important, and picking up the salt. One of my favorite things that I did, which was on the advice of Christine, was to just choose one shelf of the refrigerator and one shelf in your pantry for the ingredients you use most often. Because what I noticed when I was working with her is that I waste so much time when I'm cooking looking for things, you know, things that I know, you know, and I can even see them. She does it by touch. But, you know, where's the olive oil? Where's the soy sauce? Where are the lemons? You know, usually those things are really, if they're just in the same place, you can reach for them much more automatically, and you save a lot of time. And I found that to be just a revelation of how much time I waste by using my eyes, looking at recipes and also looking for ingredients.
And then how about one using our touch? You talk in the piece about figuring out if fish is done by touching it.
That's a pretty common way for chefs to gauge doneness. You don't like to think about them having their thumbs all over your food in the kitchen, but frankly, that's really the best way. And if you go read the article, there are ways in which you can have press on your different parts of your hand, and it feels like a different state of doneness for like a steak or a fish fillet. And also with fish, this is a really useful thing. If you have a small sharp knife, just slide it into the flesh and then press it to your lips. And fish, particularly, doesn't get very hot. So when it just feels really nice and hot, like a hot shower, that usually means that your fish is done.
Julia, thanks so much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Julia Moskin. She's a food writer for the New York Times, and she joined us to talk about relying more on our senses when we cook. You can find her list of 10 ways to develop your food senses on the Central Time Facebook page.